This is Conor Lennon from UN News. A dusty old suitcase that lay undiscovered for decades in a backyard shed in Australia has revealed an astonishing story of friendship, courage, and resistance to the Nazi regime and its extermination camps, where millions of Jews were systematically murdered during the Second World War. Letters inside the suitcase relate to an Australian family with a generational commitment to peace, whose friendship with another family in Germany, the Schindlers, produced a network bonded by a powerful sense of humanity to save people's lives. On the eve of the International Day in commemoration of the victims of the Holocaust, Julia Dean from our UN country team in Australia spoke to Dr. Francis Newell, whose mother and grandfather were part of this network who, together with the Schindlers, helped Jews, political dissidents and other persecuted groups escape the horrors of the Nazi regime.
Central to this story is a Berlin family of social democrats who were called Max and Malvina Schindler, and they had two children, Rudolf and Edith. And this whole family resisted fascism with indomitable courage and ingenuity from the 1930s to the end of World War II. So what happened was that in the wake of Hitler's appointment as Chancellor of Germany in January 1933, the National Socialist regime launched a wave of repression and persecution against their political opponents. They arrested tens of thousands of social democrats and communists, banned the communist and social democratic parties and trade unions, and they also launched a purge of government employment in which Max Schindler lost his job with a city council because of his social democratic politics. And in response to all of that, what Max did, because he was an English speaker and a translator, he came up with an ingenious idea that potentially provided him with an income, because he'd lost his job, whilst also being true to his values and ideals. So what he did, he set up an English language school in Berlin that enrolled Jews and other Germans who were targeted by the Nazis. This was to enable them to gain English skills that they needed in order to get entry into the UK or the USA. And Max supplemented his classes with advice on how to navigate the visa and permit system, which was very, very complex. And he also escorted his students to the UK from Germany to assist them with their immigration arrangements. In the UK, he used his network of progressive contacts to find board and lodging and employment for his students.
So how did your mother become involved and what was her role?
So my mother was Evelyn Parker, and the beginnings of her story go back almost 100 years now, back to 1928, when she was a 16-year-old schoolgirl in a small town in Lancashire in England. And her parents, Ivy and Christopher Parker, were keenly interested in peace and social justice because of Christopher's First World War experience in the trenches. So because my mother grew up in that sort of household where politics and international affairs were frequent topics of conversation around the kitchen table, she developed a longing to travel and to see the world, but money was scarce and overseas travel was very rare in the 1920s. So instead, she came up with the idea of finding a pen pal, a teenager from another country with whom she could exchange letters and find out about another way of life. So she asked her mother, how do I find a pen friend? And her mother said, well, maybe you could write to the editor of a particular journal the family subscribed to called the Labour woman. So my mother did that. She sent off the letter in 1928. Lo and behold, the letter that my mother wrote to the Labour woman was printed and appeared in the 1929 edition. And that edition, in turn, made its way to the Schindler family in Berlin. The Schindler family were English-speaking. They subscribed to a number of progressive magazines, and so they received that one. And their son, Rudolf, Max and Malvina Schindler's son, Rudolf, responded to my mother, and they became pen friends. So then that friendship that had taken root so serendipitously blossomed during the summer of 1930, when the two young people shared summer holidays with each other's family. At that time, they still thought that it was possible that the future would be positive. Later, Max, Malvina, and their daughter Edith, so Rudolf's sister Edith, visited the Parkers in Lancashire, cementing the friendship between the two families. And Evelyn again visited Berlin in the summer of 1933.
Evelyn being your mother?
Yes, yep. Evelyn, yeah, my mother. But by then, of course, the economic and political situation in Germany was becoming increasingly chaotic and threatening. My mother's lived and worked with the Schindlers in Berlin for most of 1934 as an English conversation and pronunciation tutor in Max's English language school.
And she knew what was going on and why the school was set up?
Absolutely. You can see in the brief notes that she wrote in about 1980, about that time, that she was very aware of the political situation and of the disaster that was unfolding in Germany.
And these notes were some of the notes that you found in the suitcase in the shed?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Handwritten in an old school exercise book in pencil. So she was never one for making a big note of herself. But here was a very modest way of recording that time. And she certainly knew that it was a very dangerous thing, that Berlin was a very dangerous place for social democrats and Jews. So whilst she went off to Berlin to help in the language school, my grandfather, Christopher, assisted the operation from England, where he placed advertisements in progressive English newspapers seeking accommodation for those seeking to flee Germany. And you asked before about Evelyn, my mother's knowledge of the situation in Germany. What she says in her notes is that when she arrived in Berlin in January 1934, Max and Malvina had already had to move out of their own home for safety and were living underground in an apartment without a nameplate on the door, which they shared with friends. And during that time, the Social Democratic Party had been outlawed, so Evelyn sometimes acted as cover for Max and Malvina's clandestine meetings with other social democrats. On these occasions, they caught up in cafes, ostensibly to meet this young English woman, but in reality to exchange information about who had been arrested, who was on the run, and who had disappeared.
So how old was she at this stage?
In 1934, my mum was 22. She returned back to England at the end of 1934. 1936, she returned to Berlin again, because by that stage, Max's language school was being offered to students in their homes. And the reason for this was that for Jews, moving about Berlin by 1936 was increasingly dangerous. They could be harassed or abused on the street. So Max offered them lessons in their own home. And we know this because Dr. Franziska Feinberg, one of Max's students, who survived the Holocaust by immigrating to America, to Max in 1947, saying, "My debt of gratitude is limitless. Not only have you saved my life and that of my family, you have shown me the greatest compassion." Then, referring to the English classes in her home, she added, "We started studying for the lesson when we saw you coming from the underground. We had so much to learn from you." And I might add that when I went to Berlin in 2019, I took public transport from the apartment building where the Schindlers lived to the apartment building where the Feinbergs lived. And so I came up out of the underground and I could see exactly what Franziska Feinberg was referring to. It was uncanny.
And what was your mother doing at this stage?
In 1936, her main role was to live in as an au pair with Paul and Elsa Rosenfeld in another area of Berlin. And whilst she lived in with them as an au pair, she taught them English in preparation for them to apply for visas to enter England. But the arrangement was risky because it involved Evelyn contravening the spirit of the Nuremberg Laws of 1935. These laws had made it illegal for an Aryan woman under the age of 45 to live in the household of a Jewish man. It was only at the very end of 1936 that she returned to England. Basically, her friends were saying, "You can't stay any longer. It's just not safe. The Olympic Games are finished. The Nazis have no longer got even that restraint on them." So my mother went back to England in the end of 1936, and thereafter she supported Max's work from England by helping his students find accommodation or employment or whatever. But of course, Max and Malvina's resistance to the Nazi regime didn't end there. It became more incredible, really, because once they could no longer help people to flee Germany, they turned their attention to supporting Jews to survive in Berlin. So from 1942 to 1945, when the regime was systematically deporting Jews from Berlin to concentration camp, the Schindlers hid Jews in their apartment. In some instances, they adopted the strategy of hiding them in plain sight, even taking them into their local air raid shelter. And again, we know this because one of the people they hid, a Dr. Ernst Nachmann, a dentist, who survived the Holocaust with the Schindlers' help, said this in a letter to Malvina in 1949. "Your apartment was a refuge for us. We were able to flee there and be saved. Malicious neighbours and housemates didn't deter you from appearing with us in your air raid cellar." So, I wanted to mention that because my mother always emphasised the heroism of the Schindlers and very rarely spoke about her own role. And so, I feel it's really important to do justice, some justice to the Schindlers, and to recognise that amazing courage during the war when the persecution and the Holocaust was in full force.
Your mother's legacy and how you've been part of it today?
First thing I'd say is that all my siblings, I've got four, have kept our mother's legacy of social justice alive in one way or another, mainly through being involved in social cohesion initiatives. But I've also been involved at a more political level in campaigning for peace, especially during the Vietnam War. The other aspect, of course, is that both Janet and I...
Your sister, Janet?
Yes, have worked together, working through identifying the letters that have been hidden away in my garden shed for decades. And in 2017, we began looking through them and realising the enormity of the story that they encompass.
Are there any photos?
Photos and postcards.
Can you remember any of the photos that stay in your mind at all?
Yes. To me, some of the most moving ones are the ones of the Schindler family prior to 1930. They were obviously a very happy family, very creative family, and their photos of such joy and optimism. And then to counter them with photos from after the war, when their son Rudolph is no longer alive, and Edith and Max and Malvina, they just look totally empty, really.
What happened to Rudolph, the son? That was the original pen pal, wasn't he?
Yes, he was the original pen pal. And his fate is really connected to one of the faces of Nazi racial ideology. So on the one hand, their racial ideology targeted outsiders, Jews, Roma, Slavs, as less than human and to be exterminated. But that racial ideology also had an inward-facing aspect where, according to the regime, Aryan Germans, who were regarded as physically or mentally inferior, they were targeted too. From 1934 to the beginning of the war, they were sterilised, but once the war started, they were regarded as useless mouths to feed in the war effort. So they could be dispensed with, and in fact, there was a wholesale murder program called the T4 program from about 1940 onwards that targeted these people. Rudolph was alleged by the regime to be a schizophrenic, detained in psychiatric institutions, and for years the Schindlers battled to get him released. He eventually died. The circumstances in which he died are unclear. The family definitely believed that he was murdered.
Do you think now, today, we need to call out any hate speech and racism, given we know what happens if we don't?
There's two aspects to hate speech. There's the hate speech that we see when, say, Indigenous people are targeted by football crowds and bullied and booed. But to me, there's also an aspect, a disturbing aspect, when government dehumanises asylum seekers and refugees. People seeking protection have been redefined as people who are a threat to our security, and therefore they're not treated as people needing protection, but as people to be detained and deported. So I think it's always dangerous when either groups of people or governments dehumanise other human beings. It's always a bad thing.